Right. So today's topic is, I think it was labeled the artwork. And so basically the topic is to talk about the ontology of art. And in the analytic tradition, you may or may not know, ontology doesn't have quite as broad a meaning as it does in other philosophical traditions. It's basically a matter of deciding what kinds of things you're talking about in terms of very large possibilities, such as abstract things, mental things, physical things, and then to say something in more detail about what the objects are, and usually that involves saying something about how you identify them or what their essential properties are. And so that's what we'll mainly be talking about today. Let me remind you what we talked about last time and what the connection is, if any. Last time we were talking about the concept of art. So we were asking the question, what makes something art? And that's often formulated in terms of a request for a definition or at least a explicit characterization or clarification of the concept of art. So last time I mentioned certain theories that might have some plausibility these days, whereas the theory that art is what aims to be beautiful doesn't seem to have any plausibility anymore. Theories such as the idea that something is an artwork if it's presented in a certain social context according to the rules or conventions of a certain institution that has been labeled the art world in some writers' texts. Or it might be that something is art if it is produced with a certain intention, where the intention is perhaps not always to make something beautiful, but to sustain or to elicit aesthetic interest, where that's characterized in a broad enough way so that that might be able to cover the whole field, even, say, Duchamp's urinal. But it has to be very broad if it's going to have any hope to cover that. You might give a definition that as a functional character rather than intentional character. So you would say something is art if it fulfills a certain function, if it sustains a certain kind of interest or engages the imagination in a certain way, whether or not it's been intended to do that, and whether or not it's an object that has a place in a social or institutional structure. Or you might take the kind of suggestion that I've tried to develop, that something is art basically if it's intended to be dealt with or regarded or appreciated as some other artwork, presumably preceding or previous artwork, has been dealt with. That has a certain obvious One positive feature of that suggestion is it looks like it might cover the whole field, since it's not very demanding, and yet if somebody has presented an object without even that kind of intention, without that sort of objective to connect to existing art in such a way that you'll sort of take this, deal with it, perceive it, react to it in some way that some other art has been reacted to or perceived, then it's not clear how you'd make sense of what they're doing as art. Oh, and it has a big obvious problem, which is that it looks like it might be circular. And it also has the problem, if you take other art to mean preceding art, that it's not clear how it would cover the very first examples of art. Okay, well anyway, those are some possibilities for how to characterize art and how to answer the question, what is art? Or how can art be defined? Or what is the most general concept of art that we operate with now and claim to be able to apply to all the, say, current candidates that we're confronted with and all the objects throughout history going back to prehistory. But the question today is not the question of what is art. The question is sort of what is an artwork? And that's a different question, although it's a related question. What is an artwork? That was too fast. There's a sense of the question, what is an artwork, where it's the same question as what is art. But what we want to focus on is a sense of the question, what is an artwork, which is different from the question, what makes the object count as art. We want to focus on a sense of the question, which is, what sort of thing are these objects that count as art? What sort of things are they, metaphysically? Are they particulars? Are they properties? Are they mental? Are they physical? Are they things that have lots of examples or have only one instance? These are the sort of questions that the ontology of art is concerned with. And most of these questions, of course, have analogs in talking about ontology generally. But art is a very complicated domain, and I think the result of that is that the ontology of art is particularly interesting and particularly kind of rich and full of sort of subtleties. All right, so what I have on the board are just, as usual, the things I don't like to talk about, just, you know, some important texts, so you can take note of them if you like. There are some, these modern classics, as I call them, and there's this sort of a second wave of work on the ontology of art, which introduces certain features that were not attended to, at least not really foregrounded in the pioneers of the ontology of art in analytic philosophy. In a word, I would say there are features of the history or the context that, according to everyone below the line, and also actually Jordan to a certain extent, features of context or history or matrix of generation that enter into what works are, and which weren't really attended to or acknowledged quite the same way by earlier writers. But that's sort of jumping ahead to the sort of view I want to push about the ontology of art. So we'll get there by the end of the hour. Most of the time, I think I'm just going to talk about a number of distinctions that are important in thinking about the ontology of art, wherever you end up. And let's start with maybe the most basic fact about artworks is that they are a kind of made thing. They are a man-made thing rather than a natural object. So artworks, whatever they are different, say, than from zebras or the wind. They're things that human beings have molded or shaped or brought into being in some way. Now, maybe artifacts aren't all of a kind metaphysically, so that doesn't tell us very much, but at least it points us perhaps in the right direction to what kind of things artworks are. The next obvious question about artworks is, well, are they all of one kind? This is a question that's divided theorists. So in other words, if you're a unifier about the ontology of art, you think that all artworks really are of the same kind. That is to say, a popular view is that they're all abstract, or they're all sort of types, to take the most recurring suggestion about what kind of abstract thing an artwork is. So it's something like a type, something like a kind of pattern or a configuration or structure that has different kinds of instances in different places, different times. But it's not identical to any of those instances, so it's sort of abstract. So one line to take if you're a unifier about the ontology of art is that all artworks are of the same kind, metaphysically or ontologically. I'm going to use metaphysically and ontologically as roughly synonyms here. That they're all of one kind, and what you might go on to specify is that they're all of an abstract sort. They're all abstract. Maybe they're all even types in the sense of the type-token distinction that I hope some of you, most of you, have heard of, but which I'll illustrate later anyway. Another possibility for a unified view of the ontology of art is that all artworks are not looking to this the issue of whether they're abstract or concrete, but that they're all sort of mental. So one view would be that all artworks are mental. Not in the sense that they're all crazy, but that they're all, they're of the nature of mental things or imaginary things. Or, more down-to-earth view, is that all artworks are really physical objects. But maybe very complicated physical objects with special features, but that they're all physical objects and that none of them are abstract. Well, those are some possibilities for having a unitary view of the ontology of art. let's look at the other side of this coin, because that seems to me is much more plausible, and it's hard for me to see how anyone really can take the first side of it. The idea that the ontology of artworks is fundamentally diverse, and that really they are different kinds. In different art forms, you have different kinds of objects that are the artwork. Sometimes they're physical, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're abstract, sometimes they're not. Since I mentioned the unifying thesis that all artworks are mental, let me speak to that for a minute. Should I also say sometimes they're mental and sometimes they're not? In other words, is there any plausibility to the idea that artworks, at least some artworks, are mental? Well, the great British philosopher of art that I mentioned last time, Collingwood, did give a certain spur to this idea that artworks are really mental things or imaginary things. Collingwood is hard to interpret. In certain passages, it looks like he's saying the artwork is a mental thing. In some passages, it looks like he's saying it's an imaginary thing. But interpretation of what Collingwood was saying is that the artwork is something like an inner state in which the motion that prompts the activity of artistic expression reaches some kind of state of adequate clarification in the psyche, in the mind of the artist. So the artwork is something like a state of clarified emotion, or emotion in a clarified state. Another way of reading Collingwood is that the artwork would be something like something maybe more like an intentional object, or an imaginative state in which there is a sort of mental analog of what we normally think is the artwork, you know, the painted canvas, in the artist's mind, and that would somehow embodies his clarification of emotion. Okay, is there really much to be said for the idea that artworks, well, Collingwood thought all artworks were mental in this sense, or imaginary. Is there anything to be said for the idea that artworks are mental? I don't think so. I think that, in my view, as it turns out, if you look at all the field of artworks, you'll find that there's some are physical, and although special, very, very special kind of physical object, and after all, you know, they sell it, Christie's and Sotheby's for millions of dollars. It must be pretty special. Whereas, you know, the other kind don't sell for big amounts of money, which is an interesting thing to think about. No one ever sells their symphony for, you know, $40 million. Why is that? Why aren't the musicians out there striking, making the ontology of art different so that they could sell their symphonies for millions of dollars? Well, I won't answer that. So back on the question, are any artworks mental? Collingwood seemed to suggest that they were. Maybe all of them were. But in my view, that's really not defensible. Artworks are either physical or they are abstract. They are things like types or patterns or structures. Now, why is the idea that artworks are mental plausible? Why does someone as intelligent and insightful as Collingwood, why was he sort of led to this view? It's really by thinking about the way we can create certain artworks, namely artworks in the musical and literary domains, in a way that we can't create artworks of painting or sculpture, namely by doing stuff in our heads. So if any of us can, of course, create a poem in our heads, especially a short poem, you can all do that. And so you're doing it by mental activity. And with at least a good proportion of us, you can also create, you know, little pieces of music in your head, little tunes. Maybe some of us can even create tunes and, you know, hear the chords as well. And maybe, you know, Mozart could actually create whole symphonies, every note intact. Actually, I don't think the evidence is that this is an exaggeration, even for Mozart. But in any case, we can all create, more or less, little poems and little pieces of music in our heads. So we're doing it by mental activity. But it's just a mistake to think that because you do it by mental activity, what you've created is something mental. What you've created is a mental event or a mental state or a mental condition. It's like thinking that because you can think about your grandmother, then therefore your grandmother is mental. And forget the humorous sense of mental here. The fact that you can think about your dog doesn't mean your dog is mental. So it seems to me at the root of this, whatever plausibility, the idea that artworks might be mental, the root of this idea is in thinking about how we can create some artworks, namely musical and literary ones, by mental activity, purely without doing anything physical. And then to think that because you did it by mental activity, what you created, what you ended up with, what you fixed or determined, to point in a more useful direction, is something mental. It's not. What you fix or you determine when you make a poem or a piece of music in your head is a kind of structure or pattern, a sort of type of thing, a set of sounds or a sequence of sounds or a sequence of words. You sort of fix that, and that counts as making the poem. Footnote here. Some people will claim that you can't actually make artworks just by doing things in your head. You have to, in some way, record them in the real world in some sort of public act, publicly observable act, like writing the poem down on the paper or writing at least a sketch of the score of the music. And you don't have to do it with, you know, musical score. You could just write down A, B flat. You don't have to use note paper. You have to do something, according to some theorists, that art making is always a public, manifested, observably manifest activity. I'm not sure why anyone holds that view, but I don't think it's right. So it seems to me intuitively that you can create an artwork in your head even before you manifest it through some sort of physical recording process. But of course, if you never did anything of that sort, your artwork wouldn't be much good. At least it wouldn't be anything that anyone else could appreciate or that anyone else could experience. So you certainly have an interest in taking your mental fixing of the poem or the tune and making it publicly accessible. But in my view, you've created the work even before you do that. If you engage in a certain kind of mental activity with a certain kind of sort of determination. When you're just thinking of notes without deciding anything, well, then that's not yet making a piece of music. But if you're playing with notes in your head and then you say, yes, this is it, you know, that's the pattern, there's my piece, then I think you've created a piece of music. Okay, this is a minor point, so let me get off this point because it's not what's of greatest interest. What is of interest is just to see that it is probably a mistake to conclude from the fact that you can create something by mental activity, that therefore the thing created has the character of being mental. Rather, it seems to me the best view to take of these things that we can create in our heads, poems and little pieces and tunes, is that they are, not that they are imaginary or mental, but that they are abstract. And that, yes, you can arrange an abstract object by mental activity in a way in which you can't, unless you're... What superheroes have, like, telekinetic powers? So they can arrange matter into different shapes just by thinking about it. Well, anyway.
Telekinesis.
What's that?
Telekinesis.
No, I know that it's called. I call it telekinesis.
Oh.
But I want to know if there were any superheroes particularly associated with that.
So Lasny Zamber series.
A Lasny Zamber?
Zelazny is the author.
Oh, Roger Zelazny.
He
had
series.
People
That's
who could do,
do
that.
They go and they rearrange matter.
Okay, well, that's, yes. So, anyway, that's, of course, logically possible, I suppose, but apparently, as far as I know, none of us can do it. But we can arrange these abstract things in our heads, and maybe that counts as making artworks, which are then a certain kind of artwork, which isn't physical, but is abstract. Okay, another important distinction is between singular and multiple arts. This, of course, presupposes that you're taking the view that the ontology of art is a diverse realm and that it can't all be reduced to one sort of thing, but has a reducible diversity. Well, it looks as if some artworks are singular. They reside in, or they really just are identical with some concrete particular object, and some artworks are not. They are something more like types or patterns. So the paradigm singular artwork is a painting, a classic oil painting on a canvas or wood or metal, whatever it's on. And a paradigm of a multiple artwork would be something like a poem or a sonata, which doesn't reside in and can't be identified with some particular physical object. What physical object would you identify a poem with if you were trying to do so? Well, the only natural candidate would be the original manuscript that the poet writes down. But don't forget, of course, that in my view, you don't even have to write it down for the poem to exist. But any poets that we know about have written these things down. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about them. So you might think the original manuscript is the poem. But that's obviously not right, since we're familiar with lots of poems of whose original manuscripts we've never seen. In fact, I've never seen the original manuscripts of any poems except the ones that I wrote in youthful misguided enthusiasm when I was in university. But I know lots of poems, although there may be only two that I can actually recite. But anyway, I'm acquainted with lots of poems, and I've never seen the manuscript. Well, maybe the poem is just the copy I own. Well, you could take that line, but it would be kind of strange. I mean, why would you think that? You really own the poem, and your friend who got a copy of the same book at Waterstone doesn't own the poem. You both own the poem, in one sense, but none of you owns, as it were, the poem in an exclusive sense, since the poem is something that anyone can own, meaning can have a copy of, that counts as an instance of the poem. So poems and sonatas seem to be multiple artworks, and paintings, and also here you have to distinguish between two kinds of sculpture that come up in these discussions, carved sculptures and cast sculptures. Carved sculptures are like paintings. They seem to consist in a particular object, you know, metal, bronze, wood, clay, marble, which is shaped in a certain way, and that's the sculpture, just that particular object. Other sculptures are multiple. They are multiply reproducible. They're say cast sculptures using. I think I said bronze before. I shouldn't have said that. But you could have a carved sculpture. Words are never quite adequate. The first category is called usually carved sculpture, but it doesn't, of course, always mean a carved sculpture. You could have a metal sculpture created by assembling a bunch of particular pieces of metal, and then you'd have a sculpture of the kind in that first category, namely it's a particular physical object, but of course that's not what we call carving. So carved has to be understood in a broad sense here. Physically shaped particular piece of matter is turned into this sculpture. But in the other case, you have a mold, you have a pattern, you have a kind of template, is the word of. A template for making a lot of different instances or examples of the sculpture. And that's sort of what you have with standard bronze cast sculpture. So you can have a sculpture like Rodin has a sculpture called the Burghers of Calais. And I think when I first encountered it, I probably had the wrong impression. I thought this was a unique object. But then I encountered other ones, and I said, they moved it from New York to Basel. And then I realized, no, I had the wrong picture of what this thing was. That's actually the last lesson I want to impress upon you in discussing these distinctions and points about the ontology of art. It is relevant to appreciation. It is relevant to understanding artworks. When I first saw the Burghers of Calais, I didn't know what kind of an artwork it was. I thought it was a carved sculpture, a particular assemblage of matter in one place and only one place at a given time. But in fact, it is a kind of type artwork. There are different castings of the Burghers of Calais. I don't know if the mold still exists, but if it does, then there could be even further ones. In any case, in principle, there could be any number of them, at least as long as there's enough bronze in the universe. There's a lot of bronze, so we won't worry about the exact number that could be made. So you have carved sculpture, versus cast sculpture. Card sculpture is like painting. Cast sculpture is more like poems or symphonies. It's like, but of course it's also unlike, and I'm going to get to that point later. There's something physical about a cast sculpture, or artworks in the category we call graphic art, etchings, engravings, woodcuts, silkscreen, that there's something essentially physical about those artworks, even though they are multiple, even though they involve something like a type or a pattern. And that difference between multiple works that have a physical basis or anchoring and multiple works that don't have a physical basis or anchoring, that can be captured by this distinction between type works or multiple works that are defined by a notation and type works that are defined not by a notation but by a particular physical template. What I mean by a physical template is something like the mold for a bronze sculpture, or the block for a woodblock print, or the original silkscreen for a silkscreen, or the etched plate for an etching. So if you think about the field of artworks and think, well, which of them are really physical and which aren't, well, it isn't the same as the distinction between artworks which inhere in or are identical to to a particular physical object and artworks which are not identical to a particular physical object because of things like cast sculpture and etching. Those are artworks that have a physical basis, and yet they are multiple. There is possible to have many instances of them. And the physical basis is what I call a template. It's a physical object that imparts a structure to any instance of the artwork, and yet the structure is not defined in an abstract way. It's defined, but defined as, like, funny quotes around it, by that particular physical object and all its peculiarities, which the artist may not be able to formulate and may have no real detailed conception of. And yet, a third point of importance, the artwork in those arts, cast sculpture or etching, is not that physical template itself. How to make that point clear? Well, if you've seen an etching by Durer or Rembrandt, you've seen a paper with some kind of ink on it, but presumably you've never seen that original plate, which is the basis of the etching, which the etcher actually makes, at least in the first stage. You've never seen that, unless you are an etcher or you're into the technique of these things from a scholarly point of view. What you see is this paper with ink on it that's made from that plate, and that is closer to being the etching than the plate is. But of course, if you remember what I was saying a minute ago, the etching isn't that particular piece of paper you're looking at either. You know, at first glance, it might seem like music and poems. Those are the hard things to get a grip on because they're not physical at all. But actually, this category of physical objects that are multiple is even harder to get a clear grip on. The etching is not the original plate. The etching is not the particular print, as we say, or what other words people use? The impression. Can you say impression about an etching? You can say it about an engraving. I think you can say it about an etching. So the engraving or the etching, which is not the same as an itching, the engraving or the etching is not the particular paper with ink on it you're looking at, and it's not the physical template, the plate that the artist worked on to make the work. So what is it? It's some kind of pattern or type of a look and a certain materials that is produced by using a template, a particular template, something like that. So it's in a way it's abstract because it's not identical to any particular physical object, but its identity is not separable from a particular physical object, namely that original plate. Why? Or what reminds you of the fact that that is in fact how we categorize these works? Well, it's this, which gets a lot of attention, the fact that forgery is possible. If you have something that looks just like an etching by Rembrandt, so that, and you make a side-by-side comparison, you cannot see any difference. However hard you look at it, it doesn't follow that the second thing is an example of the etching. The second thing may just be a forgery. Now, what does that mean? Is this just, you know, BS? How could it be a forgery? It looks just like the original. I mean, let's assume that you are looking at an authentic, you are looking at an authentic print or impression of the etching. This looks exactly like it. You know, the paper's the same, the ink's the same, all the pattern, everything's the same. So why is it a forgery? Well, why is it a forgery? The reason it's a forgery is it wasn't produced in the right way. Leave aside whether you think the fact that it's a forgery means it's less aesthetically valuable. That's, of course, a big topic, which I don't want to get into because that would absorb all the rest of the time. But in any case, just focus on the question of why is it a forgery? It's a forgery because it wasn't produced in the right way. It wasn't produced from the template, which is the physical anchor of that work of art, which was the thing that was actually worked on by the artist. So it doesn't have that causal historical connection to the thing, the template, which anchors the identity of the work, even though it isn't itself the work. Okay, what about art forms where there's no template, there's just notation? Well, that's standardly the case for music and, let's say, music in the classical tradition and literature, including poems and novels. Plays are a somewhat more complicated case. But plays, if anything, you know, theater pieces, are clearly multiple works and are at least partly fixed by or defined by a notation. But let's just stick with poetry and, say, sonatas, because those are some simpler cases. You write a poem by, as it were, setting down a sequence of words, and that counts as a kind of definition of the poem. You write a piece of music, let's just say a simple melody for flute, by writing down a sequence of notes in the standard notation, saying, there it is, that's it. In these two cases, what you're doing is sort of defining a structure. You're defining a structure of words, a structure of sounds, and anything that instantiates that structure in the right way, I'll come back to what that is, will count, and as an instance of the poem or of the melody. Notice that there is a difference, though, between these two cases, and sometimes people lose sight of that. The interesting thing about writing a poem by using a notation to fix a particular instance of the notation is that you end up with the poem by doing that. And if you look at that notation, you're looking at the poem. If you read that notation, you're reading the poem, you're appreciating the poem. It's not the same relationship in the case of creating a simple piece of music, a sort of just melody line for a single instrument, by writing a notation. Since if you look at the notation, you're not experiencing the piece of music. Sure, some of us can look at the notation and then imagine the sounds in our heads because we have training of a musical sort. But even so, that's not the same thing as actually experiencing the piece of music. In order to experience the piece of music, someone has to take that notation and perform it, you or somebody else. And then you can experience, namely hear, the piece of music. So in both cases, the notation serves to... Here I want to be careful because I'm going to introduce the qualifications later and I don't want to contradict what I'm going to introduce later. By fixing a kind of sequence of sounds in a verbal notation, you create a poem. By fixing a sequence of notes in a musical notation, you create a piece of music. But the notation, in the case of the the poem is the poem. There's really no difference. Whereas the notation in the case of music isn't the piece of music, it's, well, we have another word for it, it's the score of the piece of music. So lots of people know certain pieces of music who've never seen the score of them. But no one could know a poem if they'd never actually seen the verbal notation of the poem, because that basically, you know, is the poem. While I'm on poetry, let me mention an interesting fact that some people have thought worthy of ontological reflection. Some art forms, like poetry, are the sort of art forms where the objects are, as I said, they're something like types or patterns, abstract entities that are not identical to any particular physical thing. And yet it looks like there are two kinds of instances that a poem can have. I mean, I should put this word on the board. Instantiable artworks and non-instantiable. It's not too different from this distinction, but hey, it's a big word I like to do. Instantiable versus non-instantiable artworks. So, you know, paintings are a clear example of something that's non-instantiable. There's just the one painting. It's not a pattern. It's not a type that you can make more of. There's just that painting. A poem clearly is instantiable. You can make lots of copies of it. And you can write them out by hand. Or you can give it to this publisher and they'll set it in Garamond. And you can give it to that publisher and they'll set it in Times New Roman. And you can just make all kinds of copies. But the interesting thing about poetry is that there's a strong tradition of thinking of the instances of poetry as being not printed copies, so you read, but spoken, recited occasions of enunciation, in other words, readings. So that an instance of a poem might be a sounded enunciation by a speaker. What you get when you go to a poetry reading, you hear an instance of the poem rather than read an instance of the poem. Now, the script is the same, but the script, the score of the poem, which, as I was saying a minute ago, really sort of is the poem, allows of two kinds of instantiation. The instantiation of a visual sort on the page and the instantiation by uttering aloud. And that's an interesting feature about poetry. And some people argue that poems as readable, written objects are the primary mode of poetry, and others would argue that poetry as a vocal, hearable art is the primary mode of poetry, and then the other one is sort of secondary. My own view is that, well, poetry is just a very interesting kind of art which admits of these two kinds of instances, and it's not clear whether which should be considered, you know, prior or more fundamental than the other. But that brings me to another distinction that's quite important that I haven't mentioned yet, performing. Some multiple artworks are performed. So let's stick with poetry since I just used that example in its special complexity. Poetry, if you take the line that it does have these two possible kinds of instances, in the kind of instance that involves reciting the poem, well, then poetry is a kind of performing art, because it could be recited differently by different people in different times in different ways with different, maybe different aesthetic objectives. But poetry thought of as a sequence of words that are there to be seen and read that exist as printed copies, that's not a performing art. So poetry is sort of schizophrenic in the way I've already suggested, and another way, and one way to cash that out is that poetry both is and isn't a performing art. All right, having said that about poetry, let's focus on, say, music, which is more clearly a performing art, unequivocally a performing art. If you just have scores, you don't have music. In order to have music that people can hear and experience, you need somebody to perform the score. So, performing a score is a way of instancing a piece of music. It's creating a sound event which counts as an instance of that piece of music. So, if you know a sonata by Beethoven, if you know the Moonlight Sonata, it's because you've heard some instance of it. and that instance was a performance. If you've seen Citizen Kane, it's because you've seen an instance of it. But, and this case is very complicated too, so I'll try not to misdescribe it. But if you've seen Citizen Kane, you've seen an instance of it, but you've never seen a performance of it. We create the instances of films by projecting them and having the room, you know, fairly dark, and not too much popcorn and bubblegum on the floor, hopefully. No, that's just that's an incidental feature. But so we project these films. That's how we instance them. But that's not performing them. And yet it is making them, as it were, unroll in time. So the difference isn't that film isn't a temporal art. Film is a temporal art in the way in which music is, that the instances take time to unfold, to be presented, and of course take time for you to absorb as a perceiver. In some sense, a poem is a temporal art too, since you do have to read the beginning, the middle, and then the end, so there's a sort of process. What isn't a temporal art? Well, in some sense, the obvious contrast is a painting isn't a temporal art. And yet, how to cash out that difference is also a bit tricky, since as any aficionado of painting will be quick to point out, you know, you could spend an hour looking at a painting. That's time. But still, I think we all know, although it's very hard to pin down, the intuitive sense in which a painting is not a temporal art, because it doesn't unfold over time, even though, of course, you can spend any amount of time looking at it, whereas a film and a piece of music are, in this stronger sense, temporal, and a poem is sort of intermediate between the two. It's somewhat like a sonata, but also in some ways a bit more like the painting, sort of intermediate. This philosopher, who I knew a bit, Richard Vollheim, once told me that, you know, he just didn't think he'd gotten a painting at all unless he spent about like an hour or two looking at it. I've never been able to look at a painting for more than 10 minutes, I guess. We all have our failings. But even though someone like Vollheim could get all kinds of infinite richness out of a painting by looking at it for 2 hours, still, there's a sense in which the painting is not a temporal art. It doesn't consist of portions that unfold in a certain order over time. Let's see, what was the point I was developing? Yes, the difference between performing instantiations and instantiating without performing. When you project a film, you make an instance available, and that's how people can experience the film. But when you make a Beethoven sonata available, you're doing more than instancing it, you're performing it. And that means something like you are interpreting. You're interpreting the pure structure of the work in a particular way. You're deciding exactly how fast to play it, exactly how much accent to give certain notes, exactly how legato or staccato to make certain passages. All these things are within the realm of possibility of instantiating a musical work in the sort of the classical tradition. And there are analogous things to say in almost every musical tradition. There's sort of freedom within which the instantiator of a musical work operates, and that provides, you know, an additional level of aesthetic interest to see how this sonata, this pattern of sound, is going to be interpreted on this particular occasion and what that's going to convey about the work or maybe even about the performer in the way of expressing the individuality of the performer. But the projectionist doesn't have that. Doesn't have that role, it doesn't have that capacity. The projectionist can do his job well or not so well. When it doesn't do it well, then people in the audience say, focus. But that's not considered interpreting because there isn't really much freedom. It's a sort of mechanical process. And here, though it's a little trickier, the same is true for pulling impressions from an engraving or casting a bronze sculpture from a mold. Those are very hard things to do, and you need a lot of skill. I wouldn't have the faintest idea how to do the second, for example. Probably scald myself to death. But in any case, whatever skill or care is required to do that doesn't count. It doesn't count as a display of interpretive choices. It doesn't count as performing the sculpture or performing the engraving or performing the film. No, only things like musical works are performed, plays are performed, and maybe poems, if we take poetry in this sense of sort of performing art that I mentioned was an option, are performed. And so what works can be performed? Well, they have to be inherently temporal, so paintings can't be performed right off the bat for that reason. They're not really inherently temporal. And they have to allow of interpretation, the expression of individual perspectives or differences via a particular way of realizing the defining structure, say, of the work in question. Another point to make about film, just in case it isn't really obvious, it's the same as the point about the mold for a cast bronze sculpture or the plate for an engraving. The film that's made is, of course, at the first stage, a big film strip that sits there and, well, Lee said that now films are made digitally, or a lot of them are. It's a strip of cellulose, a film strip, and it exists in a lot of different reels, perhaps. I once projected in a course on philosophy of film, I projected for my students, and I guess it was 16mm, Fellini's 8.5. I hadn't seen it all that recently, so they got to see it filmed with reels 2, 3, and then 1. They didn't really notice. But I fessed up later, and then I gave them an interpretation of the film based on the way we actually saw it. Then I gave them an improved interpretation based on the way they were supposed to have seen it. In any case, those reels, which I no longer deal with, we now have DVDs, those reels, which are the first stage of producing a film as an object in the real world, are not the film in the sense that the film is an artwork, because people don't see those things. They see this set of images on a screen, assuming proper conditions of projection. They don't see that film strip. The director sees it, technicians see it, but we don't see it. So the film isn't that. So really, it's the same as the case as the other cases we've been talking about, where there are art forms where the artwork is something abstract that has instances. So you could see, Burn After Reading in this cinema, you could see it in that cinema, you can see it maybe at home on DVD. The film is somehow something more abstract than any of those particular screenings or projections. And yet, as in the case of cast sculpture and engraving, the film's identity as a film is tied to some particular physical artifact that's created in the process of making the film. Again, the digital era for photography and film has changed some of the terms of that issue, but let's leave that aside as obscuring the more important point. In the pre-digital era, in any case, there was a particular physical object that anchored the film, a sort of master print. Okay. Without that, there's no film. But the film isn't that. The film, that's something that anchors the identity of the film, but isn't the film itself. The film itself is something that you can view in the theater, and that different people can be viewing at different times in different theaters, and all be experiencing the same film. And the film has properties like takes an hour and a half, or it lasts an hour and a half. But the thing that's sitting in those thin cans of film reels doesn't last an hour and a half. It lasts, for lucky, a century. So it's not that. It's something else that's made accessible through that. All right, let me say a little more about how these terms are used. So I've talked about artworks that have instances. And in some cases, the instances are performed, and sometimes they're not performed. And that's roughly the same as saying, in some cases, the instances embody interpretations of the work, and in some cases, they don't embody interpretations. So a screening of a film doesn't embody an interpretation of the film. And some artworks are unique physical objects, so it doesn't really make sense to talk about them having instances, unless in a degenerate sense you want to consider the unique object the sole instance of the work. But I think you shouldn't even think that, because that leads you to think that the painting is really a kind of type or abstract thing that you just happen to have one instance of. But I think that's the wrong picture of painting or carved sculpture. As those concepts have developed in our culture, we might decide to change them. Some people have argued that we should abandon the fetishism of the unique object, but leave that aside. The fact is that we do have this idea that a painting is a particular concrete object, and that the painting doesn't exist apart from that concrete object. So I would caution you against saying that the painting is an instance of anything. It's just a particular physical object. So those are different possibilities for instances. But what about the copies and reproductions? So most of us have not seen a lot of the great paintings of the world, but we've seen reproductions of them. So what are those? Well, they're reproductions. That is to say, they are usually the photographs of the paintings that give you an idea of what the paintings look like. But when you look at the reproduction, you're not actually seeing the painting. You're getting an approximation of the painting. Copy is often used synonymously with reproduction when we talk about visual artworks, but it gets tricky if you then move to verbal artworks like poems. If you talk about a copy, then a copy is an instance. But a copy of a painting, meaning a photograph you have in your fancy art book, history of art book, is a reproduction of the painting, but it isn't an instance. So copy is a bit of a weasel word. Sometimes it means kind of instance, sometimes it means a reproduction, a representation of, representation of an artwork, which isn't the artwork or even an instance of the artwork. But what about forgeries? What are they? Well, forgeries are generally copies. Now, I'm talking about visual art. They're copies of artworks, but they're a special kind of copy. You all know what that kind of copy is. They're the kind of copy whose provenance, whose history of production is being distorted, the presenter of it is not being honest about it. So a copy by itself isn't a forgery. A copy is only a forgery when it's presented as if it were the original work, or, if you're talking about, say, an engraving, as if it were an instance of the original work. Let's see, which way should I go now? Let me talk about this distinction that Goodman introduced, which you see in some of the discussions of ontology of art. It's a distinction between allographic and autographic art. How many people have heard of this distinction? Anyway, autographic, allographic, I don't need to write that on the board. It's very hard to write on these things. I don't even want to dignify them with the name Blackboard. So autographic art is art, according to Goodman, is art that it's possible to forge. And that means it's art where the identity of the artwork has to do with a particular history of production. So if the history of production, where the thing you're looking at or listening to came from, matters, then the artwork is forgeable. Because forging an artwork is presenting something, claiming it to be the artwork or an instance of the artwork when it isn't. So in other words, claiming it to have a particular history of production, it's that painting that was made by Vermeer on that occasion in 16, 17. Give me a date for Vermeer. 1685. How's that?
He's sound dead good? By then.
What?
I think he was dead by then.
He was dead by 1685. Poor guy.
Yeah.
All right, I'll give him 1650. Okay.
I think that.
Adjust the facts so that they are historically accurate. It's a forgery if it wasn't actually painted by Vermeer on a particular occasion, or if it's a question of a print. It doesn't actually come from the woodblock or the plate or the whatever that a Rembrandt worked on a particular occasion, but it's presented as if it was. Allographic art, according to Goodman, is art where forgery doesn't make any sense. That the only thing that counts is something like how it looks, how it appears, or more exactly, how it is spelled, as he puts it. Whether it has the words in the right order. Whether it has the notes in the right order. Goodman's idea is that music and literature are allographic arts because genuine instances just have to have the right spelling, the right conformity to a notation. They don't have to have been made in a certain way. They don't have to have a particular relation, historical relation to a particular creator's activity. Whereas in the forgeable arts, there is this connection to a particular creator's historical situation and activity, and if that connection isn't present, then it's a forgery. Leave aside whether somehow you might say, oh, it's aesthetically, it's good. It's still, the question is, the point is that it would be inauthentic if it didn't have the right connection to a historical act of creation. I've argued that Goodman's distinction is really a bit misformulated, is misplaced, because of the things that are emphasized more in these more recent writings about the ontology of art, namely that musical and literary works are not really pure structures, even though I've been talking about them so far as if they were, and that musical and literary artworks really do have identity conditions that do relate them to historical acts of creation by particular people in particular contexts, and that not only are they created by particular people in particular art historical cultural contexts, but that's actually part of their identity. So that if you had a musical work with the same structure, same sequence of notes, but was created in a different art historical context, it would, I might stick a weasel word in here, but maybe not, invariably be a distinct artwork, musical work. And if that's the case, if that's the case, then you can't identify the musical work with that pure structure that the notation defines, and thus, in principle, it should be possible to forge a musical work too, namely, to make a performance that you present as the performance of that work that really is, don't leave so anyone would want to do this, there really is the performance of a different musical work that just happens to have the same structure in the pure sense. And even the same for poem. You might say a poem is forgeable too, if in fact you could have two poems that were different poems and yet had the same sequence of words. I know if you never thought of this idea before, this is going to sound, what is this guy saying? He's just talking nonsense. But the key, of course, to seeing this possibility is not the work of any philosopher, but a work of a great Latin American writer who has provided a wonderful lesson in this point to philosophers for 60 years or so, namely Borges, Jorge Luis Borges. And a number of his stories, the most relevant of which is called Pierre Minard, the author of the Quixote. How many people are familiar with that? Okay. Borges' story, it goes like this. He describes of course, this is fiction. It doesn't matter, it makes the point. He describes a French symbolist writer of the early 20th century named Pierre Minard. And Pierre Minard decides to take up as a project to sort of, and here it's hard to know what's the right verb here, but I'll use this verb, but it's not quite right. He wants to rewrite or recompose, but those are the wrong words. I'll stick better words in eventually. He wants to rewrite or recompose or re-arrive at Cervantes' Don Quixote. But not by copying it, but just by kind of arriving at it out of his own personal, cultural, historical situation. Now, Borges doesn't explain how he ends up doing this, but somehow he does manage to do it, at least in part. He creates a few chapters. So what you have is, finally, is you have these chapters that Minard writes as a early 20th century French symbolist poet, and then you have, you know, the things that Cervantes wrote, and they look the same. They look like the same words, the same sentences, in the same order. And yet, as Borges very cleverly and brilliantly illustrates, they have all kinds of different properties. And here I need to pull out of my metaphysical bag my favorite philosophical truth, which is called Leibniz's Law, which is basically the idea that if two things are the same thing, then they have all the same properties. And then the kind of converse of that is if you've got two putatively same things and they have any different properties between them, then they're not the same thing. How many people have heard of this principle? It shouldn't be confused with another principle which is slightly more controversial. It's called the identity of indiscernibles, which was a favorite principle of Leibniz. That principle goes in the opposite direction. It says if things have all and only the same properties, then they're the same thing. That also seems very plausible, but that has a little that's a little less manifestly true. Anyone who thinks about Leibniz's law and doesn't see that it's true is crazy. That's my view. That's my rock bottom test of sanity. But whether you think the identity of indiscernibles is true, that's a little more debatable, and there's some important test cases in the literature which suggest that maybe it isn't quite true. It's just very close to true. In any case, all we need today is Leibniz's law to make the next point. If there's any properties in which two putative things diverge, then they can't be the same thing. Okay, I'll go back to Maynard's chapters and Cervantes' chapters. Should I even bother to try and guess what century Cervantes is? 16th? Any Spanish literature specialists? 16th sound good?
No, or 17th? Around 1600,
1605. Oh, okay. So, okay, good. Then I wasn't wrong. It's hard to say whether it's 16th or 17th. In any case, when we look at these old chapters by Cervantes and we look at Minard's, they're textually identical. Well, one way that this point has been formulated in an essay by Greg Curry, for example, in Mind, I don't remember when. But not too long ago, work and text. They have the same text, but they're different works. So what are the differences between them? Well, Cervantes' chapters were written in the quotidian, everyday language of his day. But Minard's chapters were not written in the everyday, ordinary, colloquial language of his day. Rather, Minard's chapters were written in a very archaic Spanish. Okay, another thing is when Cervantes talks about chivalry and military ventures and so on, you get the sense that he is approving these kind of chivalric ideals. When you read Minard, given his cultural situation and his contemporaries, you don't see that. You see that he's criticizing, that he's parodying, that he's he's taking a sarcastic distance on these chivalric and militaristic ideals. Or third point is the issue of illusion. It's one of the easiest ways to make this kind of point. There's an allusion in Minard's text to some of the prevailing ideas of the pragmatic philosophy, pragmatic theory of truth, that what's true is what's useful. This is not a true theory of truth, by the way. But anyway, it has certain appeal. What's true is what's useful. And you can sort of read that in Minard's text. You can hear that. But when you see the same sentences in Cervantes, you don't get that the sense that he's alluding to the rise of a pragmatic 19th century philosophy. So in terms of these kinds of differences, these works are not the same. Yet they have the same text. Okay, so just to finish with that point. Examples of this sort, and I have a bunch of examples of this sort applied to music in this essay, where you have the same kind of structure defined by something like the same score or notation, and yet you have works that are different because they have different semantic, aesthetic, and artistic properties, even though they have the same structure. Well, what makes the difference? Is it magic? No, it's the fact that the work is something like a structure as presented or fixed in a given cultural, interpretive, historical context. And that difference of context is what makes it have some of these different semantic, elusive, aesthetic, artistic properties. And so probably the right view then to take of what musical and literary works are is that there's some kind of a fusion or complex of a defining structure, or let's say a core structure that's less misleading, and a generative context in which they were, in which this structure was chosen, was selected, was arrived at by a artist with a particular, you know, artistic identity and objective and surrounding context that allows us to interpret what these works are expressing or saying. Very much, there are millions of examples of this sort of thing. Basically, one way of summarizing the point is that artworks are really like utterances. And just as in using language in ordinary context, you can make different utterances using the same structure, the same set of words, according to who's speaking and what the context is. Artworks, it's really the same thing. They're much more complicated kinds of utterances than when someone says, pass the salt. But, or stop doing that. But they're not fundamentally all that different. And they illustrate equally well the idea that the vehicle, the core structure, set of notes, set of words, can be used to do different things, to express or say different things from one context to another. And thus, the most reasonable conclusion is that the identity of these abstract works that are, whose structure is defined by notation, pieces of music or literary works, are not those structures per se, but something like the complex or the fusion of that structure and a generative context. So the same structure as put forward by a poet at this time and as put forward by a poet at another time will be a different work of art, the same for the same set of notes as put forward by a composer at one time or put forward by a composer at another time. But there are a lot of details there that I have to run over. Okay, I think I'm close to out of time, so let's see what else I want to say just to finish. Well, let me just end with the point that I advertised is really the most important point about discussions in the ontology of art. Apart from the intrinsic interest of the sort of puzzles of figuring out what the landscape is of the different kinds of artworks that there are, it's that an appreciation and understanding of an artwork depends on getting its ontology right. Depends to some extent on figuring out what kind of work it is, what counts as constituting the work, what counts as contingent or variable from occasion to occasion. What is a defining feature of the work, and what is just a feature of this particular instance? So, for example, when you hear a piece of music performed, you want to know whether it is a notated classical composition, or not classical, it's a notated composition, or whether it's an improvisation. If it's a notated composition, then what you're hearing is an interpretation of that composition, where the special features of the sound event that you're hearing are received as a reading or a realization of that general structure, whereas if it's an improvisation, then you don't hear it in the same way. You don't hear the choices, the details of the music as it unfolds as a way of viewing a pre-existing structure or work that has an independent identity, but just as the manifestation of musical impulses on an occasion leading to a concrete, physical, event type particular work, which is musical improvisation. That's a kind of physical particular work, which isn't a type, which isn't an abstract structure at all, but which isn't a physical, which isn't an object in the narrow sense, but it's a kind of event. And such an artwork, of course, we can experience it after it's over, but that's because we have recordings. Jazz recordings are not artworks, but they are recordings of the artwork, which was the improvisation on that occasion. In any case, if you're just listening to a performance, you want to know, is this a performance of a work that has an independent identity, so that the specific things I'm hearing musically are a perspective on that work, or am I hearing a series of sounds that is not essentially aesthetically to be referred to some kind of independent work of which it is a reading? Or in the case of a graphic work, like an engraving. If you know it's an engraving, that matters. It's important to know whether it's an engraving or whether it's an etching. Now, actually, that difference I'm going to talk about maybe next time when I talk about the relevance of particular art forms and their technical features to appreciating works in the art form. So for now, I won't focus on that difference. Why is it important to know whether it's an etching or an engraving? It is. But I want to focus more on why it's important to know it's etching, engraving, or one of these multiple works as opposed to a drawing. It's important because in a drawing, every specific feature you see of marks on the paper is part of the work as the artist conceived it or at least endorsed it. If it's an engraving or an etching, the print of one of these things, then it's not. Then some of those very specific visual details are not essential to the work, but are just an artifact of the particular way the ink took or the texture of the paper that is used in that particular print you're looking at. And that's important. It's important because, I should have said this before, but these issues about the ontology of artworks, many of them can be framed in this way. Namely, what are the essential features of the work and what are the contingent features of the work? If you don't know what kind of work it is, then you don't know whether a particular feature that you're perceptually accessing is an essential feature of the work or just a feature of a particular instance or token. I should have used that word before too. Type versus token. And that makes a difference as well. So I think I'll just stop there. There's lots more to say about the ontology of art, which is, as you can probably tell, one of my favorite topics.